Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with violinist Lila Josefowicz. The MacArthur Fellowship, so-called Genius Award recipient, speaks about her new role as artist in residence with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Susan Lewis considers lesser-known works of 19th century composers Felix Mendelssohn and his sister Fanny Hensel, as the Philadelphia Singers prepare a weekend concert exploring the influence of Bach on the two siblings. And David Patrick Stearns profiles Tony Bennett, a legendary crooner, returns to Philadelphia for a performance at the Academy of Music on Friday. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra has a new artist in residence, violinist Lila Josefowicz, known for her dynamic performances, adventurous repertoire, and engaging way with audiences. Her relationship with the Philadelphia Orchestra and the city stretches back to her early teens, when she and her family moved so that the 13-year-old Lila could study at the Curtis Institute of Music, where her teachers included Jamie Laredo and Yasha Brodsky. In 1992, at age 15, she made her Philadelphia Orchestra debut. Her love of music and prodigious talent had been evident early. The story goes that as a very young child, with perfect pitch, she could sit at the piano and match the sound of the vacuum cleaner. When she was 3 years old, her family moved from their native Canada to LA, where she began Suzuki violin. By the age of 5, she was studying at the Colburn School of Music with Robert Lipset, one of California's most renowned teachers. Since graduating from Curtis, Josefowicz has had an active career in recitals, as a soloist, and in recordings. A champion of new music, Lila Josefowicz chooses repertoire that includes both contemporary and conventional fare, and also performs works written specifically for her. As the Philadelphia Orchestra's artist in residence, she will perform as a soloist, host a family concert, and play chamber music.
I think it makes sense. I know the orchestra really well. I went to Curtis. I'm from Philadelphia all my teenage years, and I think we've done a lot of interesting things already together. More standard works, shorter works, newer works, some John Adams here. We did Thomas Addis's Concentric Paths here. So we've done a lot of different things, and we know each other pretty well, so it seemed like a pretty natural fit.
Is this part of some master plan? Because you seem to have the gift to be able to do pretty much what you want and never cause any offense.
I'm glad it seems that way. I just have passionate feelings about a lot of the stuff I'm doing, the new music especially, and I've made it my specialty. So hopefully it's a trust issue as well. Like if I bring it somewhere, people will understand that it'll be done in a really convincing way.
As you're also doing with Standard Rep, that the two seem to have always fed into each other, the new music and
actually, I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to show this year is that, as you just said, they shouldn't be kept completely separate, nor do they need to be. In fact, one leads to another very, very clearly. And the more standard works are refreshed by the newer works. So they do fit. People, I think, in the last 20 years sort of wanted to compartmentalize the newer stuff from the more standard things. And, you know, this person does this and that person does that. And so I think I'm really trying to just make it more accepted by all.
Would it have been easier for you if you hadn't followed this path? If you'd just done what many of your generation did, which was to play, you know, the war horse concertos and make a great living out of the circuit, so to speak. Do you think your life would have been easier, if perhaps less artistically satisfying?
I actually think it would have been harder, because I just don't understand the appeal of everyone doing the same thing. So for me, inspirationally, it would have been much harder. And then sometimes I'm eccentric. I don't know if my tastes appeal to everyone or not. I mean,
well,
not
they're certainly
everyone.
Very Catholic, very wide.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I had to do something that I was excited about. It was sort of a last 10 years, it was a turning point for me. And I had to kind of figure out not so much what was going to be good for my career, but just what made me very excited about playing. Yeah, I had sort of a crossroads couple of years where I could have just continued on, and then there was this amazing explosion of this new way I wanted to do things in my head, so I went with that.
And how difficult was it to convince the people around you, and indeed people in the orchestral world, to, as we said earlier on, do it Leela's way?
I mean, perhaps in the very beginning it was harder, but luckily I'm very honored to say that I have the composers. I'm fans of them and they're fans of me. And I often have chosen pieces written by composers that conduct so that we can do this together.
2 years after the fact, has the MacArthur Fellowship been a good or a bad thing?
It's hard for me to think of a way it's not a good thing.
Well, I guess the fact that there are such high expectations when you get sort of that reputation, no?
I just have a path at this point, and that was sort of a beautiful recognition of that path. But obviously, whether I had gotten this or not, I would be on the same path. So to continue as best I can, finding the really amazing, interesting composers out there, get them known, even the ones that aren't that well known, to make them more known. I'm at a stage now where I've played most of the really well-known composers, and there's going to be more and more of searching and introducing of newer composers, which I think is a huge, important thing to do.
You said you stayed on the same path, but clearly there was a financial benefit to this. Did the money that came from the MacArthur thing change anything? Did you make things easier for you?
It does make things easier for me, in that I just have in my mind that much more space to, if I want to buy an instrument, or if I want to take more time for study, I don't have to say in my mind, oh, well, I got to take 3 more dates this month because...
Just to pay the rent, right?
Exactly. So those are the biggest ways it would help.
If we were speaking in, I don't know, 5 years' time, do you think you would still have this general philosophy that, you know, music, new music is worth caring about and worth advocating for, and that, you know, as the Composers Forum slogan goes, you know, all music was once new music?
Absolutely. I cannot imagine how that can change at this point, considering that half of my best friends are composers.
Violinist Leela Josefowitz, the Philadelphia Orchestra's Artist in Residence.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The German composer, performer, and conductor Felix Mendelssohn was greatly celebrated during his lifetime, but after his death in 1847, while some major pieces continued to be performed, much of his music fell out of favor, especially in Europe. Today, his most famous compositions represent only a fraction of his total body of work. Recently, however, scholars have begun re-evaluating Mendelssohn's place in the musical pantheon, and musicians are giving performances of works rarely heard by modern audiences. Tonight, a concert by the Philadelphia Singers explores the influence of Bach on some of the lesser-known music of two Mendelssohns, Felix and his sister Fanny, a composer whose body of work was suppressed even during her own lifetime. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the lives and legacies of these prodigious musical siblings.
Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto is among the most performed works in the canon. R. Larry Todd, professor of music at Duke University and author of Mendelssohn, A Life in Music, as well as Fanny Hensel, the other Mendelssohn, says it's one of the composer's standard concert pieces that survived the centuries, along with the overture to Midsummer Night's Dream, his octet in E-flat.
The Italian symphony, the Scottish symphony, if there was an oratorial society, they were for sure singing Elijah, especially in England. But a lot of his other music had been sort of forgotten or wasn't performed that often. And there was an uneasy sense that, yeah, he wrote this incredible music, but the general wisdom was, well, he didn't rise to the level of a Beethoven or a Brahms or a Bach.
This sentiment evolved after a lifetime of acclaim. A short and very intense life, Mendelssohn was born in 1809. At 6, he was studying piano. At 9, he made his first concert appearance. He studied philosophy with Hegel at the University of Berlin, as well as art and literature. He painted landscapes, composed poetry, and translated texts.
You know, he lived to the ripe old age of 38, so 3 years longer than Mozart. So like Mozart, Mendelssohn was this prodigy whose life is sort of meteor-like, and packed into his life is just an amazing amount of music, not just compositions, but he was, of course, one of the great pianists of his age. He was arguably the leading organist of the entire century. He was also, it's not well known, a violinist and a violist. He could pick up a part in his own octet and play that. And of course, he was one of the seminal conductors of the 19th century. He's one of the first conductors to conduct using a baton.
He conducted the Gewandhaus Orchestra in Leipzig and founded the Leipzig Conservatory. He traveled through Europe to Scotland and England, and he composed symphonies, concert overtures, concertos, chamber music, choral works, piano and organ music, and songs. Yet when he died in 1847, he had two strikes against him, says David Hayes, music director of the Philadelphia Singers.
Part of it was the growing anti-Semitism in the late 19th century. And while Mendelssohn's own direct family had converted, his grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, was one of the most famous of the German Jewish leaders in the late 18th century. As this sort of virulent anti-Semitism appears in Europe and in the German-speaking lands in particular, Mendelssohn becomes a casualty of that.
Also, in the second half of the 19th century, tastes in music were diverging. A group of composers, including Franz Liszt and Richard Wagner, thought of Mendelssohn as too traditional, says Larry Todd.
He died in 1847, just before the 1848 revolution. As far as Wagner was concerned, music before the 1848 revolution was old music. That was the old order. Mendelssohn was a composer who was still writing in the classical forms.
Mendelssohn did honor tradition in a way that these contemporaries did not.
He was a huge fan of Bach's, and his performance of the St. Matthew Passion at its 100th anniversary in 1827 was kind of the spark that set off the great 19th century Bach revival. Most people thought Bach was a composer you studied. He was an intellectual composer. The idea of performing Bach was sort of, you know, you're crazy. Why would you perform Bach? But Mendelssohn was the first to really turn around and say, hey, these great works of Bach, the St. Matthew Passion, we should perform these works.
Tradition, says Larry Todd, was part of his upbringing. In fact, his whole family was immersed in the music of Bach.
His sister Fanny was playing the well-tempered clavier, at least the preludes from memory, when she was 14 years old. His mother, Leah, had grown up playing the well-tempered clavier. He had an aunt, Sarah Levy, who was one of the patronesses of Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, one of Bach's sons. His father collected Bach manuscripts.
Felix and his sister Fanny studied in Berlin with Carl Friedrich Seltzer, who had been a close friend of C.P.E. Bach.
These are musicians whose brains were sort of wired for counterpoint. They just love the complexities of this music. They love the chromaticism, the intricacies of writing fugues and canons. Also, of course, the chorales.
Although Felix Mendelssohn's mastery was neglected after his death, his sister Fanny's creative output was dismissed even during her lifetime.
She was a child prodigy with perfect pitch like her brother, an extraordinary piano virtuoso. We know that she was working on the Hammerklavier of Beethoven. Not many pianists, women or men, were doing that. And yet, for her, her creativity was channeled into concerts at the family house.
Fanny was encouraged by her father, says Todd, to stick to songs and piano pieces. And until recently, that's pretty much all she was known for. Several of her songs even made it into her brother's collection under his name.
There's the anecdote of Felix going to Buckingham Palace to see Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, and Queen Victoria wants to sing a song of Felix, so she opens up his Opus 8 and Opus 9, his first two collections of songs, and she chooses the song Italiane and sings it, and then Felix has to admit to Her Majesty that, well, actually his sister Fanny Hensel composed the song. We knew about that, but we had no clue that Fanny composed hundreds of pieces.
After the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, Manuscripts of both siblings, which had been held in family archives in East Germany, were made available to scholars. While researching his book on Felix, Todd became aware of a large body of work by Fani, more than 460 compositions in a variety of forms.
The string quartet, overture, concert arias, large-scale piano cycle, the piano trio, and these cantatas. So she finally reached the point where she began to publish, and the first reviews came out, and then tragically she died. And after the 1848 revolution, her music was just forgotten. I mean, most of it had never really been known.
Hensel's work, Hiob, is a cantata set to the text of the Bible's Book of Job, where Job asks God, why?
Why does God allow all sorts of suffering to be placed upon mankind?
Hensel's work in some places recalls the style of Bach, in others the style of her brother, and in still other places, something uniquely her own.
I find her music in some ways is much more adventurous than her brother. And I don't know whether that's has to do with the fact that being a woman in the 19th century, her compositional output had to be suppressed because that certainly was not a socially acceptable thing for a woman in the 19th century to be doing. And therefore she felt freer to, in some ways, go in a more adventurous harmonic direction. Or whether it's a direct reflection of the text that she chose to set.
Among music by Felix getting fresh attention is his Magnificat, written when he was 13 years old.
It's everything you imagine a piece by a teenage composer to be. It's exuberant. It's, you know, he's absorbed all of his counterpoint, all of his theoretical lessons, and it's just as if he's having fun showing off what he can do compositionally.
The exploration of music that's rarely been performed from a composer we think we know, such as Felix Mendelssohn, is exciting. Finding a treasure trove of works by a composer who has always been in the shadows, like his sister, even more so. New music, it turns out, is not only waiting to be created, it's waiting to be discovered, challenging the history books and shining a new light on the past to better understand the present and fuel creative energy for the future.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Singers will present a concert of music by Bach and the Mendelssohns tonight at the Church of the Holy Trinity at 19th and Walnut Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. A pre-concert discussion at 7 in Field Hall at the Curtis Institute of Music will feature Rutgers University Professor of Music History George B. Stauffer, a Bach scholar, and the Mendelssohn scholar, or Larry Todd. One of the great living links with the heyday of the classic American pop song is coming back to Philadelphia. Tony Bennett, at age 85, sings at the Academy of Music on Friday, doing what first made him famous 60 years ago and has kept him in front of audiences ever since. The songs of Gershwin, Arlen, Porter. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met up with Bennett in his Central Park South artist studio, where he spilled a lot of the secrets to how he came to be who he is and how he kept from becoming the mid-career fatality that's so common in his world.
Close your eyes. Rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. Close your eyes.
The orchestrations have definitely changed, but Tony Bennett is fundamentally the same talent he was in 1950 when Philadelphia DJ Ed Hurst was one of the first to take a chance on the young Italian-American singer from New York, born Anthony Benedetto, but rechristened Tony Bennett. Though he was occasionally induced to follow passing fashions in his many recordings, Bennett emerged as a fashion unto himself in the late 1980s when he was rediscovered by the American public, appeared on MTV, and sang duets with the much younger K.D. Lang. He continues to enjoy a late career sales resurgence. Amid those six decades, Philadelphians have heard some of Bennett's landmark performances, including a 1958 collaboration with Count Basie, in which Bennett was not only among the first singers to cross the color line, but kept doing so, first at the Latin Casino, and then moving on to more august venues.
We really greased up the walls of the Academy of Music that night, and at the end of the concert, it was a lovely spring night. Right next to the Academy of Music is a parking lot. So Basie was there just, you know, smoking a cigarette, and I came over and I just started chatting with him. And some white guy came over to him. He said, "Get my car." And Count Basie said, I've been parking cars all night. You're going to have to get your own car that quick.
A number of lessons were to be learned that night, both in terms of music and the real world. Bennett became a civil rights activist and something more than a crooner, a true jazz singer. But as much as Tony Bennett talks about the turning points in his life, the seeds of so much that he was to become, both good and bad, were there at the beginning. His support for civil rights began during his service in World War II. His jazz leanings bloomed after the war, when a New York vocal coach, one Mimi Spear, set him straight on who his idols should be.
Mimi Spear was right on 52nd Street, the great jazz street, and told me not to imitate other singers because you'll just be one of the chorus, that you have to imitate musicians, find out how they're phrasing, the trombones, the saxophone, the piano players. So I liked Art Tatum because he was just the most unbelievable piano player and phrased very different. And Stan Getz had this beautiful honey sound. I put those two together, and that's how I got my own style.
Bennett also learned vocal technique dating back to opera's bel canto period.
You know, it takes about 15 to 20 minutes a day. You don't have to belt it out like an opera singer, you know, but you just do the vowels, you know, A-E-R-O-U, and you get to place your voice and just try and get your voice to sound wider. There's a lot of technical stuff, like don't sing way up in the head, you know, sing on the bridge of your nose. It comes out very controlled.
The third lifelong pillar in his career is his taste in music. Bennett spent much of the 1950s battling with Mitch Miller, who controlled artists and repertoire for Columbia Records, and pushed Bennett to record fluffy novelty singles, rather than the full-blown jazz-slanted albums he longed to make. Crossing powerful recording executives is playing with fire, but those instincts were later affirmed by a very different musical personality, Fred Astaire.
He wrote a song called Life is Beautiful, but he used to come over to my home when I lived in Los Angeles, and we'd chat about working on that song. But one of the things he said that changed my life completely, he said, don't make a move without care. He said, you don't know how quick it is to find yourself in an alley and saying, how the heck did we get here? Don't make a move without quality, without caring. And that really stayed with me. I mean, then I really said, okay, from now on, this is my new commitment, that I just will not make a move unless it's just right.
One of Bennett's most artistically acclaimed decisions was a late 1970s collaboration with jazz pianist Bill Evans, in a recording made with just the two of them, no orchestra.
You don't know what love is until you've learned the meaning of the blues.
Bennett is extremely proud of these discs, despite their being made amid the pathetic spectacle of the pianist's heroin addiction.
It was a period in his life where his whole body would swell up and he'd have to lay down after he played a 20-minute set. And here's this very, very handsome man, highly educated. And I told him once, I said, did you ever think of stopping? He said, Tony, I wish that the minute someone stuck a needle in my arm for heroin, I wish someone would have knocked me out so I would have never done it again.
A few years later, Bennett had to confront his own drug dependence, which escalated amid the national disillusionment of America in the 1970s, not to mention his slumping career, his debts with the IRS, and a failing marriage.
When everybody started getting assassinated, from the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, you know, the whole American dream kind of was smashed, just like someone throwing a brick in a plate of glass, you know. And as a young man, I started delving into drugs, and I found myself hiding. If I had some marijuana or something like that, or a cocaine, I would hide from everybody, you know, and sneak around. And one day I finally realized there was Jack Rawlins, who managed Woody Allen, who was a friend of mine, and he said that he handled Lenny Bruce years ago. And he made one sentence that changed my life. He said, he sinned against his talent. I dropped everything. And then I realized, as I started sobering up, I was able to relax. I felt so much better. I didn't have to sneak around or hide or lie about anything. It's really helped me so much.
A theme that reappears again and again in Bennett's autobiography titled The Good Life is the futility and destructiveness of anger. Bennett quotes Duke Ellington as saying the time he might spend getting angry over a racial slur could be used to write 3 more hits. And Bennett, for that matter, could probably substitute anger time for one of the many paintings in his Central Park South studio. That's not to suggest that Bennett is whitewashing himself or the crazy recording industry. He simply hasn't become cynical.
It's a con job, you know. I mean, Harry Belafonte, we started out together. So he said to me recently, about 6 months ago, do you remember when they just give us 5 cents a record? You know, but you can't linger on that. It just hurts you. When you're angry, nobody else gets hurt except yourself. The anger affects you physically. You get headaches. You have bad indigestion. You can't sleep at night. You have migraine headaches. You know, you don't have to do that. If you're just alive, you say, hey, life is beautiful.
What an interesting sentiment that is, in a time where the newest fad is t-shirts that say, I'm not angry, I'm from Philly. Imagine life without anger. Tony Bennett does.
Life is beautiful and fine, but darling, only because
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Tony Bennett performs at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia on Friday. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.